Welcome to the Engaged Midwife Podcast. This is Kira.
And this is Missy. Welcome I'm back. Missy. Hi.
How are you?
I am in my depressive phase of winter.
Seasonal affective disorder.
It's sad because I just came back from the sunshine like 48 hours ago, and already I am slumped into the sky is gray. I will never see the sun again. And there's only like 8.2 seconds of daylight every day.
I can get that. I'm sitting in my house with all of my family at home on a snow day. And I can also think of this time of year as really cozy. And I love, you know, fixing dinner and having everybody under one roof and you know where everyone is. And I can look out at the beautiful snow. But I get it. A lot of people suffer from seasonal alterations in their mood.
It's not even snowy here. I would rather stare at the snow than this like gray, misty disgustingness that is outside of my window. So if anybody else is out there and you're in a disgusting part of the country listening to this podcast, I feel you. I see you. I can't wait for it to be spring. Take me someplace warm.
The good news is it's coming. Sun will come. I promise.
Maybe. Don't believe you. Speaking of sunlight, this is so funny. That was a really fun segue and totally unplanned one. What are we talking about today?
Well, we're going to talk about something that can be treated with sunlight, kind of, a little bit, sort of. Is that a bit of a stretch? But
no, because I'm going to tell you why. Tell me what we're talking about.
Well, we're going to talk about RH and ABO incompatibility in the newborn.
In the setting of jaundice and hyperbilirubinemia. Right. And so this is a fun story, right? The discovery of why phototherapy works for babies who have hyperbilirubinemia is because a nurse had these babies in a nursery and just randomly she was like, maybe the babies would like some fresh air. And she took them out and took them for walks in the sunshine. And then their jaundice got better. And they were like, oh, maybe there's something to this link of being outside in the sunshine and jaundice. And so really that is how we came up with developed this idea of phototherapy. So if you didn't know that story, now you know that it was a very smart nurse that just decided to take some babies on a walk that really discovered the benefits of phototherapy.
It kind of goes back to that idea. Was it Florence Nightingale that talked about like air, water, like it was kind of one of the basic things of nursing and that she wanted to get those babies out into the fresh air and sunshine.
Sunshine. My gram said that when I was a baby that the doctor told my mom to put me in the window.
Yeah. I have told patients that as well. Like
put the baby in the window.
Yeah.
All right.
Those midwife tricks.
We have done an episode on some jaundice things, and I am going to just do a quick overview of why babies get jaundice. And then we're specifically going to dive into ABO and RH incompatibility. Okay. So, cause I know that this can be confusing for people, and what really has to happen in babies, right, is they are born with a ton of red blood cells, more than what adults have. And their red blood cells have a pretty short lifespan. So what happens is those red blood cells have to break down. I have a really great graphic that if I was teaching class, I would pull up and I would walk through all these steps. But basically what has to happen is bilirubin is a byproduct of red blood cells breaking down. And that byproduct is not water soluble, right? So what has to happen with bilirubin is unconjugated bilirubin has to go to the liver and be conjugated with albumin in order to become water soluble so that it can be excreted in urine and feces. If you don't remember this, the reason that urine and feces are the color that they are is because of bilirubin. So the whole conjugation process has to sort of come together in order to avoid people getting hyperbilirubinemia or jaundice. And so when that conjugated bilirubin sort of gets into the gut, it gets also then broken down by intestinal bacteria, so it can be excreted. So the physiology is red blood cells have to break down. Bilirubin is a byproduct. Byproduct has to be conjugated so that it can be excreted, right? So jaundice happens for a variety of reasons. And some of it has to do with babies can't conjugate their bilirubin. They're not processing things through their gut or their intestines. They've had some sort of injury, or they have some sort of pathophysiologic process that's going on in terms of causing their jaundice. So I am in Barney right now. So if you are not feeling great about newborn, there's a nice chapter 38 in Barney. It's on neonatal care. It's got lots of topics in it. If you're studying for boards, just remember you're probably only going to get 13 graded questions on newborn. So, but it's a short amount of time that we take care of babies up till 28 days. And jaundice is certainly one of the things that I feel like is most common when we talk about newborn care. So this is a great place to study and focus in on this chapter. Okay.
Well, and so, I think that this is also helpful though in antepartum care when patients have questions about their blood type and why we care. And so the conversation, the amount of questions you may get could also be antepartum questions as well.
Yeah, this is kind of a crossover podcast between newborn and antepartum. I feel like because when we talk about ABO and RH, it does have antepartum implications that then also lead to newborn outcomes.
Yeah.
So really four types of hyperbilirubinemia, and I'm just going to give you a brief sort of overview, and then we're going to take a deeper dive. So physiologic jaundice, that just means it's jaundice that is happening because of a physiologic process. Generally, day 2 to day 4, the bilirubin slowly goes up and it peaks around day 3 or day 4 of life. Less than 13 is the limit, right, for physiologic jaundice. Hyperbilirubinemia is another category. This is jaundice that actually occurs during the first 24 hours. This is sometimes what people call pathologic jaundice because it appears early, right, before 24 hours. And then that bilirubin peaks, it goes up, it has a very high, like it ramps up really fast up to about 5, but it still only peaks around 13. 13 is a good number too, just as a reminder. At 48 hours, the high cutoff for what we consider high risk bilirubin level is 13 at 48 hours. So I think that's a good also thing to remember in your head if you're like babies usually get discharged at 48 hours. Right? Or 24, which the number at 24 is 8, by the way. Mm-hmm. When you're looking at the graph for the high risk bilirubin levels, it's 8 at 24 hours, 13 at 48. So, you know, we're not hitting that high risk zone at 13. So with hyperbilirubinemia, or what we consider pathologic jaundice, you can still have persistence of jaundice-like features after a week. But these babies are the ones who have risk factors, right? They have cephalohematoma, so they've had some bruising someplace probably related to birth. They have an ABO or RH incompatibility, right? Or they have some sort of polycythemia. So those are places you can kind of put all those together and set them aside with like that pathologic hyperbilirubinemia. Then there's two other kinds of jaundice. And I think that these are a bit more confusing for people to sort of parse out because they both have to do with breast milk. One of them is breast milk failure jaundice. So this happens in the first week of life. The bilirubin can be greater than 13. It's always in babies who are exclusively breastfed, right? But these babies are also, when you think about this definition, breast milk failure jaundice, it's because moms are either not producing enough, there's something going on with the breastfeeding process, babies aren't bringing enough milk down, they're not getting enough nutrition. So these babies can look sort of dehydrated, they have low urine output, they can lose weight. I can give you a very relevant example of something like this. And this is babies who have a really bad latch because they have like a tongue or a lip tie. So they're not effectively bringing the milk out of the breast. The other example is women or moms who may have hypoplastic breasts and they're just not making enough milk. So babies get jaundice because they're not able, there's not enough milk for them to ingest, for their bellies to be working to help to conjugate that unconjugated bilirubin. Fair?
Yeah, because we want them to poop it out, right?
Correct. The more you eat, the more you poop, the less jaundiced you are. Yes.
Right.
This other breast milk jaundice is pretty normal. And this is when you get jaundice after about a week. It can persist for a long time, 12 weeks. But these are mildly elevated bilirubin levels that don't really require any kind of treatment. And these are also babies that are eating well. They're having normal weight gain. They're having normal output. They just look a little yellow because they've got a mildly elevated bilirubin level that does not warrant any kind of intervention.
And that has to do with the enzymes and the milk and that sort of, it is a breast milk issue. More than anything else. And you're right. It kind of just resolves itself.
Correct. So I think just having a general understanding of jaundice is important because when babies present, right, you can be like, okay, are they breastfed? Are they bottle fed? That helps you differentiate, right? Do they have any risk factors, right? ABO, RH, cephalohematoma, those kinds of things. Also, as an aside, there's another one that's really, I think, interesting. And this is premature babies who have, they can't conjugate, right? They have like delayed conjugation related to their prematurity. That's another reason for jaundice. So I think you really need to think about physiologic versus pathologic versus I am having a significant feeding issue with like breast milk failure in terms of why babies have jaundice. But today, we are going to focus specifically on ABO and RH incompatibilities because I think these are the ones that you can't, there's nothing you can do to fix them, right? But you can be prepared.
Right. So you talked about the different reasons that a baby could be jaundiced. And the two that we're talking about today, RH incompatibility or ABO. Incompatibility were first described as hemolytic disease of the newborn, HDN. And it was noted back as early as 1932. You may have also heard the term erythroblastosis fetalis. And that had to do with pregnancies that had fetuses that were impacted because of the ABO or RH incompatibility. And the introduction of Rogam drastically changed things. And Rogam was introduced in 1968, and that significantly reduced the number of babies that we see with RH incompatibility. But that's a little bit of an overview that these are hemolytic. They cause that breakdown of the cells, and therefore the babies aren't able to handle that excess of red blood cell breakdown.
So basically, like if we're seeing patients in the antepartum setting and they have a negative blood type, which honestly is a more rare, right, than positive blood types. And actually some of the literature says it's like up to 80%, right? Positive versus negative or 85% positive versus negative. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is a huge amount of people who have positive blood types. But it's women who have negative blood types whose babies may be at risk for RH incompatibility.
Right.
Why? So the why is if they mate with somebody else who is RH negative, it doesn't matter, right? They're both negative. They're going to have a negatively blood typed baby.
Right.
That's the first thing. If mom is positive, RH incompatibility doesn't matter either, right? Because she already has all of the things that she's going to have in terms of antibodies. The problem presents itself when RH negative mom and RH positive dad fall in love and have a baby. Or, yes, I shouldn't say it has to be a mom and a dad. It could be a variety of different ways. But if a baby is conceived with a RH negative mother and an RH positive other person, then we have a problem with RH incompatibility. And it's not a problem in the first pregnancy, right?
Right.
So in the first pregnancy, Rh negative and Rh positive get together and have a baby and everything is fine, right? But what happens in the context of that pregnancy is that there is some autotransfusion of fetal and maternal blood, right? They mix up during pregnancy and during birth.
Right.
Not very much. It's usually a tiny amount, but it's enough that if the baby happens to be Rh positive and that blood mixes into mom's Rh negative bloodstream, then that mom is going to produce antibodies against an Rh positive baby, a future Rh positive baby. Okay.
So this is interesting. Yeah, Missy, as little as 0.1 milliliter of fetal blood entering the maternal circulation is significant enough to cause alloimmunization or this incompatibility.
That's so crazy. It's like a drop of blood, one drop.
Yeah, it says that 15 to 50% of all pregnancies have that amount of fetal transfusion into the maternal circulation. That's a lot of, that's a lot. Yeah.
Don't mess with that. So do you understand then, like what I want our listeners to understand is first pregnancy doesn't matter because right. The baby's in there and there's no, mom doesn't have any antibodies and it's all the things, right? What happens is if that same Rh negative and that same Rh positive come together and have another baby that happens to be Rh positive, mom's then got all these antibodies. And it's going to be like, no, 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 you are a foreign thing. I do not want you in my body. And mom's now antibodies for Rh positive are going to attack said Rh positive baby in subsequent pregnancies. So, and it leads to, it's bad. The fetal outcomes are bad. It leads to high drops. Like it's really not a good prognosis for babies who have these kinds of Rh incompatibilities.
Yeah.
So what do we do about it?
Well, you've hit on a lot of really important information. I want to summarize it really fast in that 15 to 25% of pregnancies are impacted by either ABO or Rh incompatibility. But only 1% of those go on to have any type of this hemolytic disease. And so it sounds like we're talking about really, really bad outcomes, which we are, but it generally is a very, very small number of pregnancies that this will happen in, but it can be so catastrophic. That's why we want to talk about preventing it if possible, identifying who's at risk and making sure that we prevent it in those future pregnancies. Okay. You talked a lot about Rh. Similarly, ABO is when the mother generally, or the pregnant person generally has an O blood type. It doesn't happen with A, it doesn't happen with B, it doesn't happen with AB. Generally, it is only when the delivering person has a O blood type, and they can similarly develop those antibodies against A, B, or AB blood that the fetus may have.
Yeah. And which ones don't matter? If mom is what blood type?
A, B, or AB.
Correct. So those don't matter, right? Yeah. Before we jump too far into ABO incompatibility, because we can't change our blood type, right?
Right.
When we talk about Rh incompatibility, We have ways to prevent Rh incompatibility and hemolytic disease of a newborn because we have Rogam, right?
Right.
Do you want to talk for a second about antepartum Rogam and then I can follow up with postpartum Rogam?
Sure. So antepartum Rogam should be given anytime we suspect that there could be a fetomaternal hemorrhage. And so we talked about that, like 0.1 milliliter mixing of the fetal blood into the maternal circulation is the fetomaternal hemorrhage. We said that it can happen in a lot of pregnancies, but there's certain things that we know that increase the likelihood. So invasive procedures like amniocentesis or chorionic villus sampling could also be trauma. So if we had motor vehicle accident or a fall and the patient hits their abdomen, potentially you could have that kind of shearing of a little bit of the placental surface that can also lead to fetal maternal hemorrhage. Anytime we anticipate any of those things, if someone has any experience of bleeding during the pregnancy and they have an Rh negative blood type, we should be giving Rogam during the pregnancy to hopefully prevent the development of those antibodies that could impact future pregnancies.
And we haven't touched on this, but in first trimester, if somebody has bleeding or has, we can give Microgam, which is that smaller dose of Rogam, which is only 50 versus the full dose, which is 300.
Right. And I was talking about giving it anytime we anticipate that there could be that fetomaternal hemorrhage, but we also, as you know, typically give a dose of Rogam to everyone that is an Rh negative blood type at around 28 weeks gestation, hoping to protect them for the remainder of their pregnancy.
Yes. So in the postpartum setting then, how long does Rogam last, right? When we give it to moms, and we generally say it lasts 12 weeks, which is why we give it at 28 weeks roughly during the antepartum period, mm-hmm. prophylactically. Then moms have a baby. And if that baby turns out to be have a Rh positive blood type, then mom will get Rogam again in the postpartum right. period.
Right.
So, and if a baby has a negative blood type at time of delivery, then mom doesn't have to have Rogam again, which is great because there won't be any antibodies. So I think when we talk about these two things, Rh versus ABO, like Rh is the thing that most people feel real confident about, right? Because we know we can give Rogam. It's like an evidence-based thing that we can give in the antepartum period and the postpartum period that's going to help mom not make antibodies against future pregnancies. But what Rogam doesn't do is actually still prevent the jaundice that comes with Rh incompatibility.
Right. And we don't have any sort of protection against blood type. So again, if mom or a delivering patient has a O blood type, there's nothing we can do to prevent ABO incompatibility, but we can be alert to the newborn that is born to an O type patient and know that they are at increased risk if they could potentially have an A, a B, or an AB blood type. And so that is why so frequently at delivery, we collect that cord blood. Cord blood should match the fetal blood type. And so we're getting that, again, blood from the fetus through their cord. And so if they are a Rh negative patient or an O type patient, oftentimes we will send that blood off to have it typed and also to do the Rh.
I felt like ABO was so hard for me to grasp in nursing school.
Yeah, agreed.
Because I was like, I don't understand. Like if you're A, you have B antibodies, right? So you can really only have A or O, right? If you're B, you have A antibodies, so you can only have B or O, right? If you're AB, you don't have any antibodies, so you can have whatever you need, which also AB blood is like super duper, like the rarest of the blood types.
I don't even know the last time I saw someone that had AB blood.
I know somebody who has AB blood, which is just very interesting to me. And then O, right, has all the antibodies, so it really can only have O.
Right.
So if you just think about like a mom who has O blood, let's just make it O positive to like avoid the dual whammy, right, of O and negative. If a mom has O blood, right, and she has a baby that's anything but O, we can have ABO incompatibility.
Right.
But if a mom is AB, she can have whatever kind of baby she wants in there and it doesn't matter.
Right.
So if you need to rewind the podcast to hear me say what I just said again, please do it. But yes, anticipating blood type of mom. And it's, like I said, we're more concerned, right, with people who are moms who have O blood types, right? because they are, have more likelihood, especially if their partners have A, B, or AB blood, to have babies who are not O. Those are the moms that, like, our little, like, spidey sense is going off, like, hey, don't forget at time of delivery that this is a risk factor for baby to have ABO incompatibility.
Yeah, and we've been talking about this a lot through pregnancy and reproduction and that sort of thing, but someone could develop ABO incompatibility from receiving a blood transfusion as well. It's why we do an antibody screen early in the pregnancy. We don't know everyone's history and whether they've received blood or previous pregnancies or any of those different things. And so there are ways that someone could become ABO incompatible or have those antibodies develop. And it could be through a blood transfusion.
Have you seen or heard of this craziness with people's blood types changing?
No.
It is actually a thing. I don't know how common it is. So I'm going to not like put it out there, but like people who've had like massive transfusion protocol because they've lost like X amount of, they've like exsanguinated basically and been like resuscitated, you know, vigorously with like lots of product, your blood types can change. Also, organ transplant. Crazy, right?
Fascinating. Yeah. So we talked about collecting that. Oh, sorry. We talked about collecting that cord blood, and we are interested in the baby's blood type and Rh status when we collect that blood. But there's another test that we also collect, which is the Coombs test. And I think it's kind of confusing to remember indirect and direct and those sorts of things. But when we're talking about the newborn's blood, we are interested in checking the direct Coombs. Because that helps us detect if there's any foreign antibodies that have attached to those newborns' red blood cells.
Yeah. So Coombs, right? Direct versus indirect are the tests that we're going to do. Do you want to talk a little bit about those?
Well, okay. So you know how you said, I'm not going to touch on that because I don't really know how it happens with people changing blood type. Similarly, I know enough to be dangerous. Just kidding, about direct and indirect. What helps me is to know that the indirect Coombs is what we do when we test pregnant women and we do an antibody screen and that sort of thing. It's pregnant and postpartum, in that we're looking to see if they have antibodies against the Rh positive blood. In newborns, we're checking that direct Coombs because we're looking to see if the infant blood type has antibodies that have attached to their red blood cells. So indirect is our pregnant and postpartum moms. Direct is checking our newborns.
You did a great job.
Okay, good.
You're so funny. You're like, I care not to do the thing. Well, you just did it and it was great. We are not going to go onto a big rabbit trail about all the different kinds of antibodies that are possibly like can be there, because there are lots. You remember that whole Duffy dies, Lewis lives, Kill kills.
Yeah.
We're not going to go there unless you really need us to, and then you need to email us.
And we're not going to get into titer levels and following someone if they have been alloimmunized or that sort of thing. I think the important takeaway from this whole conversation is exactly what we started with Missy talking about jaundice and the different causes of jaundice. And with jaundice, we're always trying to prevent kernicterus, which is a really tragic outcome of jaundice that is untreated or undiagnosed. And so understanding which newborns are at risk, making sure we're doing really good skin assessments, that we are thinking about our transcutaneous bili levels or our serum bili levels, that we're typing the blood if we have an Rh negative mom or a type O mom, and then really watching for the development of that jaundice and treating it appropriately when we find it.
So I just want to tack on to what you just said, is that, like, remember when I said 13 at 48 hours, it's milligrams per deciliter, 13 at 48 hours is just the line that above that is the high risk zone for jaundice in babies. But a total Billy that's between 25 and 30 milligrams per deciliter is associated with this neurologic dysfunction. It's called BIND. It's bilirubin induced neurologic dysfunction. And that's when the bilirubin starts to cross the blood brain. I cannot say this fast. I need to go slow. The blood brain barrier, and then the bilirubin starts to bind with brain tissue. So that's when we get, and what we know about unconjugated bilirubin, so the bilirubin that has not been bound to albumin, is that it's very neurotoxic, and it can cause then acute bilirubin encephalopathy. And so that, again, like that's when we talk about connectoris and all of those other like bad sort of outcomes from
irreversible damage.
And yeah. The term connectors
is one of those things.
Yeah. It's chronic and permanent sequelae of that encephalopathy. And they end up with permanent cerebral damage because of this hyperbilirubinemia.
Connectors should be a never event. When we talk about never events in healthcare, this should be a never event.
So I also wanted to go back and just tell you quickly when we were talking about Rogammon, it's something that I should have interjected when we were talking about it, but what is actual Rogammon? How does it work? Rogam is an anti-D immunoglobulin. So when we talk about, because in other parts of newborn care, we talk about immunoglobulins, like with somebody who has hepatitis B, right? We talk about immunoglobulins. So this is the anti-D immunoglobulin, and it is a plasma derivative. So technically it's a blood product.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is it prevents the maternal production of anti-D antibodies. And when we give it, it does reduce the risk significantly by 95% for immunization.
Yeah.
Allo immunization, excuse me.
We're really lucky to have it and to be in a time period after 1968, because prior to the introduction of Rogam, while it wasn't super duper common to have this hemolytic disease, it was common enough that it was catastrophic to the people that did experience it. And Rogam has significantly reduced that.
Right. And if you go back to the things that you and I love to talk about, like IgG and IgM, what's happening is mom is having an IgM response if she has a positive baby and a negative blood type. So she's forming IgM, and we're trying to prevent her from having IgM that then turns to IgG and is then always circulating. It's interesting. If you go back to, there's some very interesting historical references about women who had a baby and then never could have a baby after that, or had like 10 miscarriages after that, or 10 babies that had high drops and all these terrible outcomes. And when you look at it, you think, oh, she probably had an Rh incompatibility.
Right.
And then Rogam wasn't something that was available. So that's just fascinating to think about, you know, how we have changed outcomes just based on this anti-D immunoglobulin.
And it may be fun to look back, you know, what is 1968 was a long time ago. 60
was a long time ago.
60 years from now, what will people be saying about what we were doing in these times? So it's just really fascinating that the longer humans are around, the more we learn about them. So really great topic.
So Kira mentioned sort of like breezed over transcutaneous versus like actual blood sampling for Billy. A lot of hospitals are doing transcutaneous screening. And what we do know is it's a really good screening, because if it's low, then there's no reason to be doing like venous samples from babies. If you test a baby right before discharge and it's like 2, great. Like you're probably not gonna have a baby with hyperbilirubinemia if their transcutaneous is 2. And I don't know the sensitivity and specificity of the transcutaneous test, but I do know that it's a valid and reliable enough screening that a lot of places are using it.
And again, good for screening on everyone, because it can tell us if we need to do more invasive testing.
Correct. Then we can follow that, right, with venous sampling. Right. But it was like we were saying earlier at the very beginning of this, like the treatment to get Billy down is two things. It's phototherapy and it's eating.
Mm-hmm.
So just as a practicing midwife who like sees women in the postpartum period, first off, jaundice is cephalocaudal, which means it starts at the top of the head and works its way down. Kara doesn't remember when Brooks was born because, you know, we have forged a friendship since our children were born, but Brooks looked like a glowworm and people would be like, Brooks is glowing. And I'd be like, it's just his face. It's okay. The rest of him is fine. But he literally, like, if you don't understand the glowworm reference, you are clearly older than or younger than 40 because glowworms were totally a thing when we were little girls.
They were so cute.
They are still so cute. Anyway, so if you're looking, and I tell moms all the time, I'm like, if your baby's face is a little yellow, fine. If it starts to work down to its nipple line or its belly button, we are a little bit more concerned. And there are numbers that correlate with those. But the one piece of advice I give my parents when they go home is you may just need to cluster feed for a couple of days. And that means you feed you just stay awake and you suffer through it and you feed every couple of hours, because what is going to help your baby not be jaundice is eating and pooping and conjugating bilirubin and excreting it. So like I said before, the more they eat, the more they poop, the less jaundice they are. The alternative to that is phototherapy. So if I'm working with parents who are like, oh, we, you know, have to go to the pediatrician in 2 days, you know, for a billy check or a weight check or any of those things, I'm like, the more they eat, the more they poop. If you're trying to avoid an admission and you're trying to avoid a more, use my word again, vigorous, course of action for a baby that has, you know, potentially increasing bilirubin levels, the cluster feed is actually something that works really well.
The other alternative would be supplementation with formula, but, or expressed, breast milk. Yeah. I mean,
I'm giving Kara a big thumbs down because I'm like, I hate supplementation, but expressed milk, certainly from a bottle, like those kinds of things, like don't give up on your breastfeeding unless there's a really significant reason.
Right. Right. I mean, it is a tool in our toolbox.
Correct. Correct. It is a tool in our toolbox. So, all right. Did we get it all?
I think we did. You know, if we'd love to know if there's other topics you guys would like to hear about, or if we need to take a deeper dive on anything that we've covered thus far, please let us know. You can reach us on socials, and we would love to hear from you.
Yeah. So thanks for joining us for the Engaged Midwife podcast. We can't wait to talk to you again.
Take care.